Hello. In these audio snippets, we have been talking about race, and we have discussed how race is like a family. And just like there are good families and bad families, then there are what you could call good races or bad races. And the goodness and badness is not derived from some inherent quality in the race. In other words, it's not that a race is born or inherently inferior or superior or good or bad. It is based, that decision of whether a family is good or bad is not based on like the bloodline or heritage or in terms of nobility or things like that. It has to do with the cultural values that have been bred and cultivated within that family or that race. And that makes the race superior or inferior in that sense, but it's not inherent superiority or inferiority. And so at the end of the day, there are decisions that are being made, willful decisions that create a superior culture or an inferior culture, and therefore to criticize something about a culture, and especially if the culture is associated to a certain race, is not evil in and of itself. That's not racism. Because you have to have the authority or the right to judge any culture, just like you can judge any family and say that's a good family, that's a bad family, this family is doing these things right, this family is doing these things wrong. In the same way, you can say the same thing about race, and that does not make you racist. Racism is when you believe that a certain race is inherently superior to another just by its existence. So it's like without either person from each race having done anything, one is inherently superior to another. That is racism. But when you criticize a race for behaving a certain way, for absorbing or embracing or cultivating certain values, then what you're doing is actually benefiting that race, because it gives that race the opportunity to correct things and improve its own life. And also it means that when you criticize a race or the culture behind that race, you are not attacking the essence of the person. And we've been emphasizing this, that and that should be written into the Constitution, into the new American Constitution, that a person's identity is not tied to his or her own race. In other words, my value, my sense, my what makes me worthy as a human being, what gives me a sense of self-worth and value, is not derived from the race I may have been born into. Because that is like saying, for example, that a person's value is dependent on whether he or she was born into, let's say, one family versus another. So if one person is born into a poor family, does that say anything about that person, anything bad about that person? Or if that person just happened to be born into a rich family, does that make that person better? Inherently better? No, there's nothing. The family you're born into is circumstantial, and therefore your sense of value or self-worth or identity as a person is not derived from the race you're born into. It's based on the decisions that you make. So if you are born into a race, but you do not embrace the bad things that are associated with the culture of that race, then if someone comes and criticizes the bad things about that culture, you should not feel offended at all, because they're not criticizing you. They're criticizing the people who are behaving a certain way in that race. And that makes it easier to accept criticism and to make improvements. Because let's say that in some situations you have embraced bad cultural values from your race, and you're practicing them because that's what the people around you have been practicing, so you start practicing them as well. And then someone comes and tells you, hey, this is wrong. What you people of this race are doing is wrong. Then if I know that my value as a human being is not tied to my race, just because this person made the people of my race look bad, it does not make me bad. This is not an insult as a person. I don't have to get defensive about it and say, okay, to defend my identity as a human being, my self-worth, I have to defend my race. No. You know, it's like if you're born into a mafia family and someone comes and says, hey, your family's going around killing people, that you're not, because your value is not tied to the family, you don't have to feel obligated to defend your family in order to defend your raison d'être, your reason for existing on earth. It's like, if you're born into a mafia family, you'll go, all my family members are mobsters and criminals, and I don't like that. So it's very important that your identity is not tied to race, and you can choose what values you can adopt. So even if you're born into a certain race, you can start adopting values from another race because they are good values. And we began to talk about the fluidity that can happen with race, because it's not tied to, it's not part of your inherent being. It's not part of your inherent values as a human being. So that's why the concept of adoption is not a problem. Just like if you're adopted into a family and that family loves you and takes you as their own son, as if you had been a biological son, then for all intents and purposes, those parents are your parents. That's your father, that's your mother, even though you may not have been physically or biologically been born out of them. They are your father and your mother, and that is their son. Even though there's no biological connection, there's an adoption that happened. And the same thing happens with races. So there's a certain fluidity, if you can call it that, when it comes to race, because it's not tied to identity. And because we began to talk about that, quote, fluidity, we then began to talk about the issue of gender fluidity, which is the thing that's been going on at the time of this recording that's gotten stronger and stronger. And then the reason why we started talking about this is that what we were saying about race might get incorrectly translated into gender and be taken as a justification for gender fluidity. Or said another way, a conservative could be hearing everything we're saying about race and say that's not valid, because if we project this to gender, then we get this result, ergo, your original words about race fluidity are not valid. But we've been trying to explain why you can't equate the two, because there's a certain fundamental difference. And we did begin to talk about that in the previous snippet, and our intent is to continue talking about that issue of gender. And even though these are snippets about race, it's important to mention gender, especially because nowadays liberals have been trying to equate the civil rights movement that had to do with racial equality and all that with the alphabet movement, LB, G, T, X, Y, Z, or whatever movement. So they're trying to equate homosexual rights with racial rights. And to this day, I'm still not clear what exactly is homosexual rights, what exactly they're talking about, because with race, racial issues, it was very clear there was racial inequality. Like in the South, you had segregated restaurants. Some, you know, the good restrooms were for white people, and the not so good restrooms were for blacks only. And black people could not participate in certain sports, be members of certain clubs. They couldn't take, they had to sit in the back of the bus, things like that. So so there was clearly a need to correct all of that. And there was a need to fight for the rights of equality. But with homosexuality, it was never like that. It's not like there was a time when you only had restrooms for homosexuals and restrooms for heterosexuals, or that only in a restaurant you had to, if you were found to be a homosexual, you were kicked out or things like that. Or that certain people cannot be hired because they are homosexual. So it's very kind of unclear what exactly they're talking about. But the thing is that to legitimize the movement, they keep trying to equate it with race. Speaking about gender in the context of race is important for two reasons. First, to clarify that race I don't like the word fluidity, but for lack of a better term, that race fluidity cannot be equated with what has been attempted to be done with gender, you know, gender fluidity. So that's one reason. And the other reason why we need to talk about gender in the context of race is to kind of establish the difference enough so that equating of racial rights with homosexuality rights, whatever that may mean, so that that equating of rights, quote unquote, be shown as ludicrous, that it's like comparing two completely different things. We want to talk a little bit more about gender in this audio snippet, beyond what we shared already. And one thing that was that we didn't mention in the previous audio snippet that I believe is very important, and this concept is also needed to be kind of put into the Constitution in some way. Not, I don't know exactly how, but it needs to be plastered in some way, so that future generations can know this principle and have it very clearly written out into the legal system, because it's a very fundamental human principle, and I believe that having that principle written there as a statement of law can help to guide future legislation about many things. And the concept has to do with collective versus individual. And what do we mean by that, and how does that relate to race? Well, I don't know if you've noticed, and I think I think it is something that most people have recognized at one point or another, that women have a tendency to do things in groups, whereas men tend to be a little more individualistic. You know, the old joke about women when they go to the restroom, they always go together. You know, if one of them, if you're like in a at a table with a lot of men and women sitting there talking, and one of the ladies says, "Oh, I have to go to powder my nose," and we all know what that means, and then she gets up and she starts asking if one of the other ladies at the table will want to go to powder her nose as well. And you never see that with a man. Like, if a man gets up and goes, "Okay, I have to go to the bathroom," they don't stand up and say, "Okay, hey, John, do you want to come with me?" You know, men don't tend to do that. But women feel a need to do things in groups. They are more prone to collaborating and to kind of getting advice from other people and hearing what other people may say and kind of coalescing a lot of different advices or, you know, words of advice from different people to then form a conclusion, whereas men tend not to seek advice from people. They don't like to ask for help. You know, the old joke about how men, when they are lost, never want to ask for directions. And the wife is always kind of harping on the guy, hey, just stop and ask somebody for directions. And the guy goes, no, I know where I am. I'm just a little lost here, but I'm going to find my way pretty soon. I don't need to ask anybody. And women are much more prone to asking for help. So there's a more collective nature to womanhood and a more individualistic nature to manhood. Why is it important to recognize the difference and to not let the two kind of blend in and get lost? We need to keep the two distinctions very clear. To do that, we have to kind of understand why it's important to maintain individualism in humanity. Why is individualism important? Because you would say, well, collaboration is good. You know, it's people coming together and thinking alike and trying to agree with one another. And why is that so bad? And yes, that is, you know, in many ways a good thing. But if you kind of lean yourself towards that, like that's the goal in life, a collective mindset, then you start losing what comes with individualism. And why is individualism important? And we can see it from the perspective of the five human personality traits that we have discussed before, that a human being's personality, and I use personality for lack of a better term, it can be composed by one or more of these components. The judgment component, the judgment quality. There's the visionary quality, the conqueror quality, the server quality, and the organizer quality. And we are born with one or more of those components. And we act it out in our lives. And we've already discussed this in previous audio snippets. But now in the context of individualism, if you're a judge, in other words, you're always judging things as right or wrong. We need people like that in life, because if there's no one saying what is right and what is wrong, then you know, we start doing things that have bad quality, things that are not good, things that are not sound. You need somebody who's saying this is right, this is wrong. And obviously that can degenerate into excessive legalism. Just because there are people who abuse the judgment attribute does not mean that you have to ban it altogether. In fact, it's impossible to ban judgment, because to ban judgment means to pass a judgment on anyone who makes a judgment. So if you make a judgment, if it's wrong to make a judgment, someone has to come and tell you it's wrong to judge people. Well, the moment they tell you it's wrong to judge people, they're judging you. So by them condemning your judgment, they are condemning themselves. You have to have someone making a judgment. It's just a matter of making the right judgments. That's all that we have to worry about. We can't ban judgments, because everyone is always judging something. And even those who hate judgment are going around judging people who make judgments. That's why liberals, who are supposed to be the epitome of kindness and tolerance, are so harsh and intolerant against conservatives, because as we said, if you are against judgments, then you will be very harsh against the people who make judgments, and thereby you become the judge. You replace the judgments that they are making with your own. So judgments are inevitable. So the judgment component is necessary. But the thing is, when you exercise the judgment component appropriately, because you're constantly discerning what's right and what's wrong, you start discovering laws and principles. Everybody who is creative, everybody who invents new things and comes up with innovative ideas, they tend to be of that judgment personality. And so they discover new truths, new ideas, things that people had not seen before, because they're constantly discerning what's right, what's wrong, what's good, this is right, this is wrong. And the thing is, to break into those new grounds, you have to be an individual. It's like you have to go it alone. It's kind of like Columbus. Columbus had this idea that we can get to India by going in the opposite direction. And everybody went, you're crazy, man, you're crazy. How can you go to India? If we know India is that way, how can you get to India by going the opposite way? And he said, no, I know we can get there. We all know that he didn't get to India, but we also know that had he had the resources and the ability, that yes, it was possible to get to India by going the opposite way. But the thing is that he had a new idea, and to follow that new idea, he had to go it alone. It's like he had to be willing to chase that dream or that that idea without a popular support behind him. And that's what innovators do. They have to be able to break away from the pack to go and try and discover new things and break into new territory. So individualism is important to be a good judge. If you oppress individualism, then you oppress people's ability to make judgments on their own. It's like everybody thinks a certain way, and then there's a certain judge that goes, no, we've been doing this the wrong way all this time. You know, it's like, for example, in the, there were certain cultures where human sacrifices were acceptable, and everybody thought it was okay. Everybody thought it was okay. Why were those cultures trapped in that? Because there were never enough judges within that culture that were willing to step aside from all that, you know, slaughtering and human sacrifice and go, okay, hey guys, I have a feeling this is not right. And then to proclaim it to other people and say boldly, no, hey, we should stop this human sacrifice nonsense. I don't think this is a good idea. It requires someone breaking from the pack and stating something that might be contrary to what everybody else has been thinking. So, you know, like Copernicus saying, hey, the sun, the earth revolves around the sun. That's what makes sense. I'm looking at the patterns of the planet. It makes more sense to put the sun at the center and the planets going around it than putting the earth in the center and forcing all the other celestial objects to go around the earth. And we all know how he was rejected and hated. Everybody thought he was wrong, and he was persecuted and harassed because of that. But he had to be willing to do it on his own. And then, you know, obviously now everybody knows and believes what Copernicus believed. But when he believed it the first time, no one else did. So you have to be individualistic to be a judge, an innovator, and a producer of new wisdom, of new truths. Well, new to us, because, you know, just like the Americas were the new world to Europe, it doesn't mean that the Americas were new suddenly in 1492 and they suddenly appeared out of the ocean. The Americas had been there all this time. They just had not been discovered by the Europeans. In the same way, there are truths out there that haven't been discovered, and the judge is the one who kind of forges the trail to discover the new truth. And again, they are new to us, but they had been there all along. We just had not found them. So individualism is important to foster judgment. Otherwise, you start going with collective judgment. And we mentioned in a previous audio snippet that I had a conversation with someone, a young man who spoke to me and said, I asked him, why he was doing what he was doing. He was promoting some union thing, and then it came down to him saying, "Well, it's because everybody believes it. It's the majority of people who believe this to be true." And I said to him, well, there was a time when slavery was, like in the South, the majority of people thought slavery was okay. Did that make it true in the South? And he said, well, no, the thing is that, but now we have the numbers, like that has been reversed. And now, thinking that slavery is good is no longer popular. Yeah, but to get it to that point, someone had to break out and say, hey, this is not right. And we have to change this. So if you're living in collectivism, then you are just following the crowd. Everybody does, you know, what's popular? Like, okay, Ukraine is to be supported in the fight against Russia. So everybody goes, oh yeah, Ukraine. Well, they couldn't, they didn't give a rat, pardon my French, but they did give a rat's ass when Ukraine was invaded in 2014, I believe it was, or by Russia, by the same Russia, or when Russia invaded Georgia. Where was the outrage? Where were the Georgian flags anywhere? When Russia stole Crimea and I think Sevastopol, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, from Georgia, if I'm not mistaken. That happened not too many years ago. And where were all these people when Russia was oppressing all of Eastern Europe? These people were doing the opposite. Their fathers, you know, and when I say these people, you know, the people of the same liberal mindset were all opposing America and kind of acting as if the Russians were the maligned people, and they couldn't have cared less how oppressed the Europeans were. But why is everybody supporting Ukraine? Because someone in the Democrat Party, people in the Democrat Party started saying that's the popular thing. We're going to support Ukraine. Hooray, hooray! Because Ukraine to them was a distraction from the problems, and it became like the conflict became the perfect excuse to justify inflation and all these other things. So they were doing it for political reasons, and now everybody supports Ukraine just because of that. But they don't understand what's really going on, or why Ukraine needs to be supported. They're supporting something, the right cause, but for the wrong reasons. And conservatives then just take the opposite. Oh, because liberals are all supporting Ukraine, then we're going to support Russia. So Russia, the Putin son of a bitch who goes around murdering his political opponents, has been doing that for years. I have been speaking out against him. People who read the website where these snippets have been posted know that for years, years ago, I was speaking out against Putin. When no one gave, pardon my French, a rat's ass about Putin, like they couldn't have cared less, and I was speaking out against it. So now that the Democrats declare Russia is the enemy du jour, and then everybody says, "Oh, Russia and Putin are evil," and then on the other hand, conservatives who are supposed to be for democracy, for liberty, for the rights of the individual are supporting an oppressor, a dictator, a former KGB operative, a relic of the old communist days who's trying to reinstate a new form of the Soviet Empire. So now now conservatives support it. So it's all this mass thinking where one side just supports it because their beloved Democrat leaders told them to, and then the other side supports the opposite because they don't like the Democrat leaders. So when you have collectivism, you have the loss of judgment. And then what happens is that only an elite few start controlling what the masses think, just like what's happening with Ukraine. that the Democrats decide, there's a Democrat elite that gets together and decides, okay, we need this as a tool to further our political ends. We couldn't care less about Ukraine. The Democrats don't care about the people of Ukraine. Look at what the senile bastard and his family have been doing, fleecing that country all this time. They couldn't care less about the freedoms of the Ukrainian people. I care about the freedoms of the Ukrainian people. And people who read the website that these audio snippets have been posted on know that we've talked about Eastern Europe and we've talked about a lot of things related to Eastern Europe. So we care about Ukraine. The Democrats couldn't care less, but they are using it as a weapon to justify the decline of the economy and to get people distracted from what's really all the mess that they're disaster that they're causing. So they make a judgment, and this elite group. So they are acting individually, in a sense, kind of thinking on their own, and then they decide what is supposed to be the right judgment, and then everybody collectively absorbs it because no one is willing to think on their own. That's why individualism, when it's suppressed, it suppresses judgment. When judgment is suppressed, innovation and the discovery of new principles and truths and ideas is lost. And the other reason why individualism is important is because it's very strongly tied to the visionary component of the human personality. To be a visionary, just like with a judge, you need to be willing to declare things that no one else is declaring, to see things that no one else is seeing, and to call people towards that vision when no one else is looking in that direction. So you have to be willing to speak on your own, and then you have to sound crazy sometimes. A visionary sounds crazy when he says, we can do this, we can do that, we can do the other, and everybody looks around and is like, you'd be crazy, man, you'd be crazy. And the visionary goes, no, I know this can happen. I know what's in the horizon. Let's move towards it. And he starts exhorting people towards that vision. So, but it's he or she. So it's a matter of individualism, where you have to be able to step out on your own. And when you suppress individualism, then you suppress the visionary trait in people. The visionary also has to be willing to die on his own. In other words, he has a vision, but he's not just seeing it and just telling people as a news reporter. He is committed to the vision, to the cause, and he's willing to die for it to see it fulfilled. And to die, and obviously, as the old saying goes, everybody dies alone. You can't die with other people, well, unless the roof falls on a whole bunch of people at the same time. But at the end of the day, you experience death by yourself, and the visionary has to be willing to die alone. Just like Joan of Arc or other people who have a vision and a cause, and even if they're the only ones dying because of it, they are willing to do it. So if you suppress individualism, then visionaries are suppressed. That's why collective societies don't have visionaries, don't have people who see new things, and that's why collective societies become very stale. So the other reason why individualism is important is to is related to the conqueror personality. As we have said in previous snippets, the conqueror personality is willing to galvanize, or is a person who is has that fortitude of will to galvanize the will of others towards the will that's in his heart. Because that's what a conqueror does. He rallies people around a war to fight. He has that kind of charisma to draw people unto him or herself, and then drive the will of people and get them aligned with the will that's in his heart, but to do that, you have to be able to step away from the pack. You have to be individualistic. It's like Alexander the Great, you know, the greatest military conqueror, I believe, in human history. He said, I can go and take on the Persians and take on Tyre and Sidon and all these kingdoms, and I can plow them down, and I can stretch the influence of the Greek society and culture and empire all the way east. And he said, who is with me? And he had a magnetism and a personality that drew people towards him and said, yes, okay, I see what you're saying, man. I'm going with you, and I'm going to go to the ends of the earth to fight with and for you. And he drove the will of people towards fighting, and he conquered country after country after country until he got all the way to India, as we all know. And then he said, okay, enough is enough, because his soldiers said, yeah, we need to go home. And he turned around and he died on the way back. But the achievement of doing all that conquering required him saying, I am going to go and conquer all this territory. Who is with me? But if you wait, like, okay, you know, if Alexander had been sitting around in I don't know exactly where he, what city he was in, but somewhere in Greece, you know, just twiddling his thumbs and asking his friends, hey guys, do you think we should go and conquer Tyre? And should we go and conquer the Persians? Because those guys look mean and nasty. Do you think that we can take them on? What do you think? What do you think? Let's have a poll. Let's have a meeting and discuss this and get everybody's feelings on the subject. You know, if he had been like that, trying to kind of get a collective understanding and a sense of, you know, should we do it or should we not do it? Is it prudent? What are our chances? What do you think, Johnny? What do you think, Peter? If he had done that, there would have never been an Alexander the Great and the spread of the Greek civilization the way, you know, it was spread. He had to step out on his own. When you suppress individualism, you suppress those three elements: the judge element, the visionary element, and the conqueror element in the human being. And when you suppress those three things, you practically have castrated the human existence. A human existence where people are not free to make judgments, or not free to have visions, where they're not free to conquer, is a stale, castrated humanity, human existence. And that's what collectivism does when it becomes the dominant way of thinking. Because collectivism has a role, but it has a role that's more related to the other two traits of the human personality. The server personality. If you think about a server, like let's say an environment of a restaurant, you have waiters and you have the cook in the kitchen and everything, and everybody needs to kind of work together. The waiters have to get organized and say, okay, this is my section of the restaurant. You know, these are my tables and these are your tables, and then they have to get together, with the people in the kitchen and you know, send the orders and say, hey, table five wants this burger without onions, and then coordinating with them to make sure that the order is right. So there's a more, to be a good server, you need to have a more of a collective thinking. Same with nurses and doctors. They need to cooperate with, you know, in a hospital setting where they are serving the patients. They need to work together and collaborate and organize themselves in such a way to serve people better. It's like individual thinking is not as important in that mindset. It obviously it plays a role, but what I'm saying is that in the server role, you have to think a little more collective. And also an organizer, that's the fifth human trait or personality, they also have a more collective mindset, and because organizers tend to depend on patterns built by others. Like organizers usually take patterns of organization that other people have created, and they kind of adopt them to organize their stuff. And they can also create new forms of organization, but they do rely a lot on history. And so they tend not to think about so much as kind of like going out on their own to do their own thing. They kind of like try to rely on what other people have done before and just adapt it and so forth, and kind of apply it maybe in an individual way, but to a from a practical perspective, but the general principle was created by someone else. They're just giving it an individual practical application, but the general principle came from before. So and also, like, organizers are obviously the people who coordinate teams, and so an organizer needs to think in terms of the whole team. Organizers think in terms of division of labor and things like that. Okay, you do this, I do that, and you do that. So they start establish procedures where after group A is done with this, they will pass the product to group B. Group B will do this. And while group B is doing that, group C is preparing this ingredient and so forth. So they need to think in a collective way as well. So that's why collectivism does have a role when it comes to the server and organizer functionalities of the human experience. But they can't be the dominating ones. Collectivism and individualism are important, but if you let collectivism take over, then you suppress those three elements of judge, visionary, and conqueror, and then you end up with a very sterile society and a society that starts going astray. And individualism is connected with manhood, and collectivism is more connected with womanhood. And just to give you an idea of that thing about manhood and womanhood and individualism versus collectivism, have you noticed that, for example, rap singers and all those people, when they're men, they have women, a whole bunch of women around them. But you don't see the opposite. You don't see a woman with a lot of men around them. Yeah, well, every now and then they have videos like that showing that, but it's not that common. It's like women find it okay to have a whole bunch of them kind of centered around a single man. But men don't feel as comfortable doing the same thing around a single woman. So you can see that concept. Like, obviously, when it comes to polygamy, usually when people talk about polygamy, everybody thinks one man and many wives. No one thinks of one wife and many husbands. I'm pretty sure that must have happened somewhere, but it's not that common, because manhood is tied to the individual, like on his own, and womanhood is tied to collectivism and that dependence and relying on each other. Where does that come from? Because womanhood inherently, biologically, is tied to weakness, physical or relative weakness. I'm not saying that women are weak. I'm saying that relative to men, women are weaker. And that weakness has a purpose. The weakness then makes them more reliant on other people. It's like they don't feel that they're strong enough on their own. So that's why they need support. And that part of humanity is important, because if there was only manhood and no womanhood, then we'd all be killing each other and like no one cooperating with anyone else. But womanhood kind of brings that element into manhood, into the human experience. So it is important. But when it's the dominant one, that collectivism of womanhood is the dominant element, then it brings destruction on the whole human experience. So this was all related to collective versus individual. And that's one difference between man and woman. And these are fundamental human differences. In other words, they are differences that are kind of different from the differences between races. And I hope you can see that there's something much more fundamental about the division of man and woman in mankind, as opposed to the division of mankind as, you know, black, white, and Celtic or whatever. So now the second thing we want to talk about regarding gender is the issue of violence. And this is kind of important to mention as a side note. There's something in man's DNA that makes him more open to violence than women. And that's just a fact. There's nothing sexist or misogynistic about that statement. It's just a reality. There's something in man's DNA that makes him more open to violence. And just think, for example, I watched a show on television called Forged in Fire. I watch reruns because I don't have cable. So, and it's a show about like bladesmiths or competing to build a sword or, you know, some sort of knife or dagger and some sort of competition. So all these guys doing the forging and hammering of the metal and all that stuff. And when they finish their product, they have to, the knives or swords are put to the test by these judges. And one of the tests that they like to do is to hang this pig carcass. And then the judge takes the knife or the sword and starts using it to chop up the pig. And the test is the kill test. That's what they call it, to see if the knife or the sword will kill. And then, you know, if the sword is very good, let's say it chops up the pig and you can see half of the pig, you know, falling to the ground and pig parts all over the place. And then the judge goes, "Your weapon will kill." And the guy who made the weapon goes, "Awesome." You know, and even I, when I'm watching it, go, "Awesome. Yes, it will kill." And can you imagine? That's not a reaction a woman would have normally, because the woman would go, "Oh, that little pig, you know, that's hanging there, you know, it's the carcass, obviously it's not alive, but the pig is already dead, it's hanging, the carcass is there." And the first thing a woman goes, you know, starts thinking about is, "Oh, that pig must have had piglets." So the piglets are now orphaned, because these, bloodthirsty TV people decided to kill a mama pig so that they could have a carcass to carve up just for the fun of it. So that's how, where a woman starts thinking. And to have a person say, "This weapon will kill," the woman goes, "Oh, so you're glorifying killing? You're glorifying murder and death and all the destruction that mankind has experienced?" That's where a woman starts going. A man goes, "Yeah, it's a powerful weapon. It will kill. Awesome." And there's something about the DNA. So, but you'd go, "Well, is that a good thing for humanity to have a part of it, a half of it, kind of like enjoying violence in some way, or appreciating it more than the other half?" And the answer is that that yes, there is a need for that. Now, and that sounds like a very weird thing to say, but you have to hear this out. You know, in the past, man needed to, you know, we all know, man needed to go hunt and kill animals to bring back food so that the family could survive. So if the man was out there hunting and he goes, "Oh, that's a little deer. Oh my goodness, the deer looks so cute, and oh, what a beautiful little animal. And if I kill that deer, does it have, you know, little, I don't know what the deer, little deer are called, but, you know, does it have little deers and running around, and they will be left orphaned? Who's going to feed them? And, oh, I can't kill it. I'm sorry. I can't do it. And, you know, if he goes back home and says, "Oh, I saw this huge deer, and it was, would have been food for like a whole month for all of us here, but I just didn't have the courage to kill it. Sorry." You know, then they would have starved to death. So man needed to have that ability to have a little bit of heartlessness and kill that deer. And no, yes, it was a cute looking deer and all that, but we had to kill it because we needed to eat. In that scenario, you can see why there had to be a part of man that was willing to engage in violence or embrace violence in some way. And obviously women need to be softer because they need to nurture young kids. As a mother, you know, raising a young baby, you know, breastfeeding and caring for the baby after it's born. A man can't do that because, you know, man is kind of like, a man holds up a baby and sometimes it doesn't know which end is up and all that. And is more prone to dropping the kid and all that. So man is more brute force. A woman is more, it was designed by DNA to be more tender, softer, more nurturer, because it has to care for something that's weak and frail, that little baby. A man is designed to be a little harsher, a little less considerate, quote unquote, to be able to do things that need to be done. And the woman is the opposite. But the question that lingers, why do we need violence? Well, I guess in the case of hunting, it does make sense. But beyond that, why is that violent, if you can call it that, tendency in man necessary? And the reason is there are two. There are two fundamental reasons. One is because there are certain problems that are like mountains that need to be tackled. Problems that are huge, where if you don't have a violent attitude, the problem will not get solved. So when I'm talking about violence, it goes beyond, you know, slashing somebody to death or something like that. It's talking about this attitude of violence, of aggressiveness. Why do we need that? Because if you're tackling a big problem, and it's an almost insurmountable problem, you need someone who has a violent nature about him to go and fight that mountain, fight that battle until the battle is won. And no matter what the cost is, no matter what the pain and the suffering is, I am going to take that mountain down, that problem down. And if you suppress that, because we all have to be lovey-dovey and tender and sweet and kind of an understanding, then the big problems will never get solved. You need someone with that aggressiveness. And man is born with more of a predisposition to do that. Women can do that too, but it's more difficult DNA-wise to do it. And usually when women can do it, it's because they've had a strong impartation of a strong male figure in their lives who's taught them how to be aggressive and how to fight and not give up and fight and have the tenaciousness to take down the big problem, the big situation. And then the other reason why we need violence is because of evil. Because humanity has the propensity for evil. And if you don't believe that, then I don't know where you've been all this time, but humanity has this propensity for doing what is wrong. And because of that, then if everybody's docile and lovey-dovey, eventually someone will rise up that says, oh, I can take advantage of all these idiots around me and rise up and become the dictator and the controller of the people and start to tyrannize them. And he will be able to tyrannize them very easily, because no one will have the courage to oppose that person. No one will have the violence in them to oppose the violence that's being inflicted on them. You know, like, for example, think of Hitler. He rose in Europe, started tyrannizing all of Europe and doing all the things he did. Someone had to rise up and say, okay, you know, because we all know, you know, what happened with Neville Chamberlain, the great appeaser. He didn't have the man, he was not a real man. He didn't have the manliness in him to fight Hitler. So he just let him take Czechoslovakia. Okay, take this, take that, take the other. We don't want to fight, you know. Can't we all get along? Let's love each other. All we need is love, etc., etc. And he just let Hitler grow. And then it became this big problem, and then someone had to come with greater violence and take him down. And so evil will rise. So we all like are like little doves and sheep and no violence and we all care about each other and we don't want to hurt each other. Then someone will come with a spirit of evil and rise up and dominate and oppress. So you have to fight evil, you have to be violent. You have to be. If there's someone killing people out in the street, you need a police officer who has the courage to take out a gun and shoot the guy down, and find him and kill him. And if he shoots at him, he has to be willing to face the bullets and shoot back. So if there's no violence, then evil will prevail. So that's why that violent tendency is necessary. And obviously, the idea is not to go around killing people, but sometimes that violence does require having to go kill people, just like in World War II, it was necessary to go kill Germans, or in go kill Japanese, because the Japanese were oppressing all of Asia and doing all this evil. Someone had to stop them. And that's where the manly element of violence becomes necessary. And to decry violence altogether is to be naive about two things: about the existence of evil in the world, and second, about the existence of things that require problems that require a spirit of violence to resolve. Sometimes you have to have that manly, aggressive determination and violent attitude to break the problem so that the problem can be conquered. So that was the second aspect we wanted to mention about man versus woman, the issue of the need for violence. And a third element is that differentiates man and woman is safety versus risk. Men tend to have a greater disposition to endure pain and take risks. And women have a tendency to focus on safety and security. Usually when let's say, and I'm pretty sure that in most that most people would agree with what I'm about to say, that in marriages, usually the wife is the man is the one saying, "Oh, let's do this, let's start a business, let's invest in this, and let's spend all this money in this investment." And the woman is the one who generally goes, "Hey, you have to think about the college fund for our kids, and remember the mortgage, and remember this, and remember the car payments, and remember that and the other, and our retirement fund, and make sure not to blow this on this." So the woman is always kind of talking about all that could go wrong, and the man is the one talking about all the possibilities and taking the risk. And obviously, this is not the case all the time, but there is a general pattern of a tendency of the woman being the one saying, "Hey, don't do this. This is stupid," and the man going, "Hey, no, let's go and do it." And so there's a tendency for man to risk and to endure the pain, because he knows that the risk will come with pain. There's a chance of pain, but he's willing to endure the pain if it's needed. The woman shies away from pain and looks more towards safety and security. And it's understandable, because the DNA of the woman is kind of intended towards protecting the children, protecting the little ones. So the woman does not want to expose her babies to unnecessary risks and dangers. But man feels the need to push the envelope. Like, for example, have you noticed that in skyscrapers, for example, when they build skyscrapers, it's almost always men who are working way up there, walking on the beams and up on the 70th floor, when the building is still being constructed, and you can look down and see the street below, and there's nothing that will stop you from reaching the first floor, if you fall down, it's almost always men. And it's not because of discrimination. It's just that women just don't feel comfortable doing that. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. I don't think I'd last a day in that job myself. But men tend to do that more than women because men are willing to take risks. So, but if there's no one taking the risk of being up there on the 70th floor, walking on a beam, with the air blowing real hard and all that, then if no one's willing to take that risk, no skyscrapers would be built, no great buildings would be built. So there is a need to have that disposition towards risk to achieve great things, like the Panama Canal, for example. All the people who died building that thing, and I would bet that the vast majority of men who died, or people who died there, were men. Very few women working in the Panama Canal, and I don't think it was because of discrimination. It's just that women just didn't want to go and take a risk like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, it's just that the disposition was not there. Because they are, so they are the balance in a sense. Because if we're all just taking risks all the time, then we'd all go crashing and burning. So it's understandable. There's an element of humanity that needs to be thinking about safety and security. But the problem is when that becomes the dominant thing, then humanity becomes stagnated. And that's exactly why the word safety has been like such a prevalent thing at the time of this recording with the virus nonsense. You know, stay safe. You know, that's safe. That phrase that would be so annoying to me when I would hear people say it, oh, stay safe. You know, like, oh, there's this evil little virus thingy out there that's going to kill us all, and we all need to stay safe, hunkered down in our little homes and basements, taking our mRNA gene therapy injections and not talking to anyone, and, you know, keeping a tape measure at hand to measure if everybody is within, if anybody gets within 72 inches of you, you know, all that over the top, focus on safety. That's a womanly thing. That's a feminine thing. But when that becomes the overriding mentality of people, it just becomes destructive. And we can see how a virus that had a 99.7% survival rate, that could not be stopped by masks because the mask holes are too big for the size of the virus. How that virus that most people, if they got sick, they would maybe, if they got infected, truly infected, would only be sick for one day or two, like a flu type symptom, heart flu symptom. How that virus that would have been survivable if we had just written it out and taken the proper medication, how that just became so destructive and destroyed our economies and destroyed so many people's lives and disrupted them in such a fundamental way. When the focus is on safety, when you are not going to take a risk, then, you know, imagine no one would go on a highway because, you know, you're not going to get killed in a highway accident if you don't get on the highway. You're not going to die of a drowning accident if you never get in a swimming pool or go swim in the ocean. If you want to be 100% safe, then what you have to do is stop doing things. You have to stop taking risks altogether. So the focus on safety, if it's exaggerated, can be paralyzing and destructive. And that's when the femininity begins to dominate over masculinity in an unhealthy way. So that's the third thing. Based on the time, I'm not sure if we have time for another one. I guess we do. A fourth difference between man and woman is tenacity versus acceptance. And that's kind of related to all that we've said already, that man has a tendency to be stubborn and tenacious, whereas woman tends to be more willing to compromise and accept. more towards compromise and acceptance. A man is said, no, I will not give up. I will not give in. He has to apologize to me. And it's a matter of principle, and I'll stand on that principle. And the woman goes, oh, for crying out loud, let's end the fight. Just call him and say you're sorry, even if you don't mean it, and let's get this over with. So she's more towards compromise and acceptance, and let's just accept the way things are. Let's not fight the system, for crying out loud. You say it's, you're fighting for the principle, you're really fighting for the money. You're so cheap, and that's why you're fighting this ticket or whatever. And the man goes, no, I have to fight this. And it's important to maintain that part of humanity, that willingness to be stubborn and have a certain tenacity to solve a problem or to deal with an issue or to stand on a principle, because that's how new ground is broken, as we said before. So those are basically the four things we wanted to mention regarding the differences between man and woman, and that's to show how deep the difference cuts into the nature of man in general. And it's a difference that is much more profound and fundamental than the difference between a white man and a black man, or a black man and an Oriental man. It is very, very kind of binary, and it's important to see the difference and the role of each, and to make sure that the womanly role, does not dominate over the manly role. And you say, well, can't they just kind of share? No, because if you have a personality, a part of the human personality that is more tending towards dominance and aggressiveness and all these other things that we've talked about, and we have another side that's tending more towards safety and not taking chances and protecting and nurturing and being tender towards weak things, you naturally need the dominant side to be more dominant. Because if they're both acting their natural roles, the dominant side, in order for the dominant side not to be dominant, you have to suppress it. So there is a need for a dominant side, and if you let it act out naturally, then it will tend to be more dominant than the side that's not designed to be dominant by definition. And when you allow the dominant side to be suppressed by the non-dominant side, then you have an unnatural situation. It's like you break the balance, the ecological balance, for lack of a better term, and you start causing problems. And we have, for example, as we were saying a moment ago, a situation at the time of this recording in the world, in America and the world, where people are just trapped in collective thinking. And that's why everybody has Ukrainian flags all over the place. Most of these people don't even know where Ukraine is. They don't know, they could have cared less about the Berlin Wall and all the suffering the Eastern European people went through. They don't care about Putin being a dictator. They didn't care before all of this. I cared. I've been caring for 20 years. To the point that, as I've shared with people, I boycotted the 2018 World Cup because it was played in Russia. The moment I found out that Russia was going to host the 2018 World Cup, I said, I'm not going to watch that. And I didn't watch a single football match from that World Cup. I followed it online, but I had a principle. I didn't watch a single game on television or anywhere. I did catch a glimpse or two of a few games by accident, you know, while other people were watching on a screen or something, and I would glance at it inadvertently, but I never watched a single game. It was the first time in my whole life. I had been watching games since 1978, since the Argentina World Cup, and watching games and following them, you know, with fanatical determination. And I didn't watch a single game. Why? Because of Putin. Where were all these people that are waving the Ukrainian flag? They have no notion. They are just doing this because it's the cool thing to do. Because if Trump were supporting Ukraine and we're the one telling people to support Ukraine, everybody be supporting Russia. And so it's collective thinking, and conservatives are doing it by counter reaction. Because all the liberals are waving the Ukrainian flag, then all the conservatives are waving the Putin flag and saying all these wonderful things about Putin, how he's a wonderful Christian, my rear end. He's one of the most, he oppresses Christianity in Russia. If you knew about it, you would know. You can't preach Christianity on the streets in Russia. You can get arrested for doing that. That's what conservatives are supporting right now, because it's the collective opposite. So we're trapped in collective thinking, and everybody's safe, you know, safety, stay 6 feet away from each other. And you have to wear your little nappy on your head, on your mouth, because that's the thing that everybody does. And there's this horrible thing, and we have to stay safe and not take any chances. When you allow that feminine collective mindset to take hold, then you get a very, very dystopian world. And that's what we have right now in full bloom. So you have to let the dominant side dominate. Because if you don't, then... But that does not mean oppression. It doesn't mean misogynism. It doesn't mean not letting women exercise their rights and their abilities and their talents, because as we've said before, there is a certain fluidity, but at a different, not at the physical level. And we wanted to get to that, but we won't be able to do that in this audio snippet. There is a certain fluidity, but as long as you take it outside of the physical level, then it's totally valid. Then a woman can act like a man and take leadership positions and be a conqueror and be a judge and be a visionary. And if you're aware of that, then things are okay. But if you try to suppress it at the physical level, that's when the problem starts. And that's what we're doing right now. But we'll talk about all those things a little more in the next audio snippet, because this one has turned too long. So thank you very much for listening.